From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a one-time refugee from war-torn Bosnia remembers how she escaped from that country.
Later, meteorologist Mike Westendorf says one of the important and challenging parts of his business is knowing that the story of weather is about more than data.
When you walk out the door, you will have an emotional reaction to what the weather is. You will enjoy it. You will be frustrated by it. And it's important to not just go, I'm angry about it, or, ooh, I love it. Ask why.
And artist Jeffrey Gibson talks about the nature of his work, which is on display at Marquette University's Hagerty Museum.
This idea of comfort is something that I've always been a bit distrustful of, because it's the minute when you're too comfortable that suddenly things start fraying at the edges.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The world is facing its worst refugee crisis in recorded history. Millions of people have been displaced by conflicts in Syria, South Sudan, and other countries.
While European nations have been grappling with the influx of people, the U.S. has placed a ban on immigration from many of the countries affected by these conflicts. But the situation that many Syrians face today is not so dissimilar from another crisis we dealt with just two decades ago.
The Bosnian War started in 1992. By the end of it, just 3 years later, more than 100,000 people were dead. Most of them were Bosniaks, victims of a genocide targeting the Muslim ethnic group.
Zijada Beganović was a young child living near Sarajevo at the beginning of the war, who later came to live in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, who first met Zijada in elementary school. Zijada starts by explaining what she remembers from her early childhood in Bosnia.
As a little kid, I didn't know why we were leaving. I just remember something was wrong and we left. We moved to Germany. My mom, my sister, and I actually left alone without my dad. And I remember coming to the small town. What I know is that what happened in Bosnia is not even just Bosnia, but Serbia and Croatia. Mainly in Bosnia, struggled the most is that the religious differences was what brought this to be a very dirty war and a very sad war. I mean, majority of Bosnians had to leave because of the danger of the war, right? So if you were Muslim, I have friends and actually even neighbors. My mom used to say her neighbor was Serbian, and every day they would see each other. They would perhaps even have coffee in the morning, because that's a cultural thing. Hanging out with friends, having coffee, morning, night, it's just part of culture, being social and seeing people. And she said things got really strange when the war was just about to begin. Like, people who were friends, Serbians, for example, and Bosnians, would stop talking to each other. So a lot of the religious stuff interfered, and people stopped being friends. And everyone started turning towards one path. So if you were Serbian, they turned to Serbia because that was probably their safe zone too, right? I mean, if you try to help a Bosnian Muslim, you might not make it through the war.
So when the war started, about how old would you have been?
So the war, I remember, actually as a little girl, we were outside. My mom was hanging out the clothes on those, what do you call them, where you...
Oh, a clothesline?
Yes. She was hanging clothes up, and I remember those fast military planes. I remember one flying over us, and I was just thinking, that was really loud. I know things got kind of scary, early 92, and we left in August of 92. So I was 4.5. My sister Jenny was 2. And we got very lucky because we were able to get out. If anyone waited... later on during that time, it was very hard to leave. Many people were stuck. If not, they wanted to stay because that's their country, that's their home, they wanted to fight. But my mom and my dad chose to leave for the safety of us, the girls.
You said that you and your mom fled. You, your mom, and your sister all fled first. Why did your dad stay longer?
I think a lot of the men had to stay to support, right, the Bosnian military. I don't know 100% to why. I know he had to for some reason. Never really asked. It just, people don't really like to talk about the past, especially the ones that are older and know exactly what happened. It's something that's not very talked about, unfortunately.
Now, do you remember fleeing to Germany? Do you remember that trip at all?
I do. It's really weird because thinking about it, even now, I can just close my eyes and like remember parts of it. But being so young, sometimes I wonder, how am I remembering this kind of stuff? Is it because of how dramatic it might have been, or is it just my brain wanted me to remember? But I know there's few memories that I have. For example, my parents actually built a house. We finished it. We were just about to move in. Beautiful home. It's still there now. It took some time to fix it. But right before we were moving in, my parents were deciding to leave, and things were getting really bad. So where our house was, it was in a smaller village outside of the town, more secluded. My dad's parents grew up there. And I remember being at our cousin's weekend house, she used to call it, and just watching out the window, just seeing black smoke. And where our house is, there's a giant field of grass. I mean, it's so beautiful. And then you have the mountains that you can see from the balcony, for example. And I remember our mom having to figure out how to get to the road, which was past the field and some trees. And she said that we ran through those fields not knowing if you're going to get shot from the soldiers that are behind you up in the mountains. So that was a challenge because you didn't know where the soldiers were. You couldn't see them. You know, they took advantage of the trees and the forest, and you just run and you hope that you don't get hit by a freaking bullet. And I do remember we were in this car that picked us up. This guy, the driver, thought that my mom was a friend of his. Apparently she looked like someone he knew who was Serbian. And he kept talking to her, just having this conversation. I remember my sister and I, we were in a back seat on the bottom, underneath, like under the seats, just trying to be protected, just in case someone starts shooting at the car. And I remember them talking, but she told me fully the story that he was assuming he knew her. And she never said she wasn't that person. He got us back into town where we were living in an apartment. So that was weird. That was probably scary for her, not knowing, like, what if he finds out? What's he gonna do? You know, you just don't know. But I remember the bus ride out of Bosnia to Germany. So we ended up getting on a bus to leave. And I remember one part of this drive, I was looking out the window, and while I looked out the window, there's half a person in a ditch and half a person on the side of the road. Same person, just two pieces. I'll never forget that. And I asked my mom about it, and she just didn't know what to say. Like, how am I supposed to know that? How is she supposed to explain that? And then everything after that was kind of blurry. I remember we finally got to some European town. I don't remember where. It might have been Austria. And we were just sitting outside. And then finally we got to Germany.
How long were you in Germany?
Let's see. From 92 until 99. What is that, 7 years?
So you were in Germany a while.
Technically, my childhood, I grew up in Germany. And then my teenage years, I grew up here in the U.S. So Germany was very open to bringing in refugees, especially Bosnian refugees, and they opened their doors, which was amazing because there were so many of us who were trying to leave and protect ourselves and survive. But around, I think like 98 is when Germany was ready to send the refugees back home because things got better and they took us in to help us out. But then, like, now you're okay, right? Now your countries are back to somewhat stable and please go home. So we had the choice to either go home or come to the U.S. And my mom couldn't resist coming here. She's like, it's America, right? It's the land of the dreams. And how can you not take that opportunity? Because because why would you go back home when your home's destroyed? There's nothing there. People are poor. Like, it's still sad over there. Like, it's getting better, but there's so much poverty there still.
When you look back at your time in Germany, as someone who was a refugee, how do you process that time?
Honestly, I think about this all the time, and my sister and I talk about it too, and even my friend Isla. It's just like something that comes up in a conversation all of the time, and to me, it feels like it's a different world. When I look back, I'm like, is that my childhood? I think about it, like, am I dreaming? Was that just a dream? It doesn't feel like it's my life, because I've had my 4 years in Bosnia, and then my few years in Germany, and then here, I feel like my life was just like taken apart in different pieces. And the past is just someone's story, someone's movie, and I'm just looking back at it and thinking, oh yeah, it doesn't feel real. I don't know if that answers your question. It's a really weird thing to think about, and like I have to say that being young in Germany too, you had kids who didn't really accept you for being a refugee. They used to tease you, and there's, in German, it's called Ausländer, which it's not the nice, it wasn't a nice word for anyone to call you. And some kids weren't accepting of you being different and coming to their country. So you had those challenges as a young kid, right? Like trying to fit in. And you find other kids who you fit in because they're a different culture.
Now, what was it like when you came to the U.S.?
Scary, only because I watch so many American movies and saw tornadoes all the time. I always say this, man, I remember the sky was pink the first like few days when we got here. And I was like, you guys, there's going to be a tornado. And my cousins, Lana and Dado, like, no, this is Lake Geneva. It's going to be fine. But I remember the drive home from the airport, just like the highway was so big. There's so much space. And because even in Germany, you had a lot of forest around you, a lot of mountains, right? Valleys. And one thing that I always found weird to me was that the blocks, the resident blocks, were squared, right? I never saw that before. So like riding my bike one day, I fell because I didn't know how to turn a corner from one side to the other. And I don't know, it was a different feeling coming here. It didn't feel real. And I imagine America to be so different from what it actually is.
You already had family in Lake Geneva, but did you feel like people treated you differently because you're nodding your head? Yes.
Most definitely. I mean, Lake Geneva, as some of you might know, is a very small, I would say conservative town. And I don't think kids knew when I came to school, right, sixth grade, I don't think kids knew what a refugee was, what war meant, what anything like that really meant. All they knew was clothes and hanging out with friends, and I did not feel like I was accepted. I found that to be very challenging all throughout middle school and high school, too. It was just, you're different, right? One of my history classes, I think it was in high school, there's like 2 pages, maybe 3, about the Bosnian War. That's all, right? And kids still don't understand who you are and why you're different. I tried to avoid telling people what my religion was, only because I didn't feel comfortable. How they would react, or there are so many perceptions about religions, and especially Muslim, right? If someone being Muslim, they might be a terrorist. Like, no, that's not necessarily true. You're just not educated about what these religions are. There's this one example in high school. I don't know if this is... So remember Sparky, our art teacher?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember Sparky.
I loved him. He called me his angel. He was my favorite teacher on earth. And there's this project that we had for a photography class. He wanted to have us take pictures of, like, something pure, right? So I remember asking my mom, I'm like, do you think it would be too much or just taking it too far by taking pictures of myself or someone taking a picture of me with the hijab on, right? And she's like, no, that's who you are. You should be okay with that. And whatever kids say, that's on them, right? Like, this is who you are. So I did that. And the pictures turned out to be very beautiful, right? It showed who I am. I'm not just Ziada with the brown hair and this teenage girl. I'm actually in also another, that was like another part of me. And there are some kids that end up taking some of those photos that were hanging up in class and writing bad things on them. They wrote terrorists and some other things like that. And to kind of just be like, whatever, I laughed with them, not thinking, like, no, what the hell, man? Like, I didn't stand up for myself. I laughed about it, and then I took it home, and I was like, what the hell? Then, a few years later, I'm like, why did I do that? Was I not confident enough, like, to stand up for who I am? Or did I just want to fit in with the others? I didn't realize, like, how bad that was for someone to do. And I hope that person and those people one day understand that that's not okay. You can't judge people based on what they look like. You need to know them as a person and then judge them if you want to. But know the facts. Don't just judge people.
With all the recent restrictions on, well, visas largely and immigration from a number of different Muslim majority countries, how do you feel about traveling right now? Does that freak you out a little?
Well, when I first found out that he was our president, Trump, I just freaked out because I'm thinking, well, I still have my green card. And many were like, why don't you have a U.S. passport yet? Why aren't you a citizen? I'm like, I still am. I'm still a permanent resident. I still have all the rights except of voting. And it doesn't mean that I'm not trying to be an American citizen. I'm still a proud American citizen. That's who I am. I live here. This is my new country, right? My home. And I freaked out because I'm thinking, well, hell, I'm Muslim. I'm from Bosnia. I'm sure at some point this country will come up in the conversations. And even now, before Trump, when I did travel, every time I came back home here, I was questioned. It always blew my mind. I'm like, why? You're like, they're asking you all these questions. Where did you go? Why did you go? Why did you stay so long? Where do you work? What do you do? Like, where do you live? Like, all these details. And then I see other people just walking through. The other time I traveled, actually last year, coming back, I was so-called detained. They took me to the other office, and I had to sit there, and they had to verify my documents even further. And I just sat there. I'm thinking, what the hell? I didn't do anything. I have no criminal record. I work. I have a degree, right? I went and got an education. I pay my taxes. And here I am still being questioned for why I left this country. Is it because my passport says Bosnia? I don't know. But trying to leave now to go on a trip, I don't know. Like, it's nervous. It's nerve-wracking thinking about it, because what if they say, no, you can't come in, and I have to go back? It could happen. I hope it doesn't, but I don't know. That's the thing.
Is there anything else that you would want people to know about your experience as a refugee and your continuing experience as an immigrant here?
I mean, like, we didn't choose to leave, right? We didn't choose to be kicked out of our home because of political reasons. We're, again, just like American kids and people live here, we also want just to live our life. We want to have a family. We want to be happy. We want to be healthy. And we don't want to be causing harm to anyone. So we're not here to take resources away, right? Not just me. We got resources in the beginning. We got support. But then we got on our feet and created this life that we can now give back to others. So don't judge people, right, based on who they are and where they come from. Get to know them, and if anything, get to know the facts of who they are and such, because every person has their own story, and what the media might say about one country or one religion doesn't mean it's true with the people around you.
Well, Ziada, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. This was great.
Zijada Boganovic is a graduate of UW-Milwaukee and a Bosnian refugee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about her experience emigrating to the United States almost 20 years ago.
We'll take a short break now and then talk about the intersection of weather and emotion with meteorologist Mike Westendorf. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWN. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. It is winter again in Milwaukee, 3 months after we got our first and until now only snowstorm of the season. A snowstorm that was initially expected to bring 3 to 8 inches of snow to the region proved to be a Lake Effect snow.
The prodigious snowfall totals were a delight to some, especially school children, while others were dismayed at the need to get their shovels and snowblowers out of the garage again. And it is that divide between the weather conditions and how we feel about them that provides the source of conversation with meteorologist Mike Westendorf, operations director at UWM's Innovative Weather. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for being here.
It is great to be with you, Mitch.
Well, let's start with what everybody is focusing on right now, which is the first major snowfall we've had in Milwaukee since December, right?
Yeah, mid-December.
And even sort of more so than mid-December, these are lake-enhanced snows.
They have, and we have not had something like this for a couple of years. We don't get true lake effect snow squalls every year. Sometimes you go 2 to 4, maybe 5 years before you really get a good lake effect snow. But everything is set up perfectly for it. We've got cold air temperatures. We've got a very warm Lake Michigan. And then you put those east winds along with a little bit of a disturbance moving through the Ohio Valley, and you have ripe ingredients for what normally would happen from Gary, Indiana, on over into the Michigan side. This happens to them all the time, but it's rare that we get it here in our neck of the woods where it's hours and hours and hours of lake effect snow, which really is quite challenging because these lake effect snow bands, you don't know exactly how they're going to set up. So one neighborhood could get 4 inches of snow, and you know, a half mile down the road, your neighbors could have anywhere from, you know, 10 to 18 inches of snow. It just gets pretty out of hand real quick.
Well, and let me go back to something you just said a couple of moments ago, and that is the significance of a warm Lake Michigan. And, you know, we can talk about just how warm Lake Michigan is in a bit, but what difference does the lake temperature make when it comes to generating snow?
Well, if it's warm, it's able to put some of that energy back out into the atmosphere. You know, think about it. Warm air rises. We generally know that as an idea. Well, you have a warmer Lake Michigan right now with the, you know, temperatures in the 30s. You got air temperatures in the 20s, and you've got not only rising motion that you're getting from that, you're also putting moisture back into the air. So you're feeding a moisture source, if you will. So it's like bringing your own batteries to your own toy. You know, you keep it going. And so it's a perfect setup for it. And that's what that warmer Lake Michigan will do. And by the way, that's true of early season cold snaps. Again, doesn't usually happen on our side of the lake very often. But in November, when the lake is still quite warm and we get one of those Arctic air masses that comes south, November, December, Lake Michigan or the Michigan side of Lake Michigan, they get pummeled with this kind of stuff all the time.
Well, and so presumably for this to be affecting us, the prevailing winds also have to be coming in a different direction?
Yeah, they have to be coming in from the east. And usually the time that we get that is when low pressure passes down to the south of us, where you get those broad east winds and they just continue there. And if it's a big storm system or slow moving, you get it for a day and a half, which is what we'll be seeing out of this one. And that's part of the reason why the lake effect snow amounts are going to be as high as they are.
Well, and so the other interesting thing about the snow that we're seeing is that it is of the very kind of fluffy variety, which has to make it, for people in your profession, a little difficult to kind of measure how much of the stuff is out there.
Well, yeah, and this kind of comes into that whole perception. What is it? So you go outside and you step on 10 inches of snow and it compacts down into a half inch, you know, because most of it's air. But if you go and stick your little measuring stick in there, it's, you know, 11 inches of snow because it's all light and fluffy. And it also changes, too, which is interesting because of the lake temperatures. And you get a little bit further inland, it's a little bit colder. The type of snowflake begins to change as well. And so in some cases, it's almost the small sticks, dendrites, if you will. And other places, it's a conglomeration of everything. So there's those big snowballs that come down. And it all happens in a lake effect environment like this one, where you get a little bit of everything happening. So it does make it challenging to measure. And like I mentioned too, snow bands, they almost like a thunderstorm, they don't have a huge width to them necessarily. And so different type of snowflake, different intensity, and that can vary quite a bit over the course of 20 miles. And that's what we're going to see. I think the story will be told quite well out of the observations of this one.
The other interesting thing is how we perceive the snow. And, you know, this is an interesting phenomenon across the spectrum of weather, that weather doesn't happen independently of how we feel about it.
Right. We've been talking about this a lot with the staff at Innovative Weather, and the idea of how do you communicate with an audience that is so diverse, and geographically they're in different places. Everybody who's listening into this program is in a different space and place, and both life, our life experiences. You know, you're 12 years old and your mom and dad have this in the car and you're like, yes, this is awesome. And mom and dad who are driving, this is going, no, this is horrible, you know. So how do you tell a story? And one of the things we talk about when I'm training our staff is when you walk out the door, you will have an emotional reaction to what the weather is. You will enjoy it. You will be frustrated by it. And it's important to not just go, oh, I'm angry about it, or, oh, I love it. Ask why. I think that curiosity is one of the things that we're losing a bit in our connected technology age, is we just want to know what it is instead of being curious about why. And so much of the learning and so much of the storytelling comes from how we connect the emotion to the why. And so when you walk outside, part of our shared experience, like, you know, again, if you're under the age of 12, you probably aren't in this camp, but just about everybody else who has to drive in it, we're going, oh.
Right, but of course, by the time you get to work or wherever you're going and you can sit and look at it out the window, your emotions about it has changed.
It's beautiful, you know? I remember, you get nostalgic. I remember, you know, being a kid and just being in, and you could go outside and play and come back in, and there is a beauty to it. And for all of us, I think that most of us who've been here and lived here for more than 20 years and call this truly home, we enjoy four seasons, and we largely haven't had winter this year. And so it is kind of nice to have it. So in the month of March, where we average 7 inches of snowfall anyway, here is our last hurrah of winter, and now all of us start to feel a little bit better, now that we've had this, about what April and May will bring with, you know, flowers and showers and all that.
But, of course, that also takes us back to February and how people were feeling about 70 degrees in the middle of a time when we might have expected 18 inches of snow on the ground. And that's got to be a difficult story to tell, because on the one hand, this, you know, there's something going on with the climate. And on the other hand, the weather is beautiful.
At a time when it shouldn't be. It's funny. I mean, it's a serious conversation. And, you know, some of the guys like Dr. Rober and Clark Evans and Sergey and some of the professors at UW-Milwaukee who are looking at climate much more in-depthly than I do. I'm looking at 7 to 10 days out for the most part. But that's a serious conversation about what climate and impacts we might be able to expect in the years ahead. One of the ideas being that global warming is it's kind of a poor choice of words to talk about climate change, because while the globe is getting warmer slowly, the impact actually seems to be more extremes more often. And this winter is a great case in point. But to your point, too, on the flip side, it's really hard to feel guilty or ask people to feel guilty about 70 degrees in February, because it is one of those days. I mean, seasonal affective disorder, it brings misery to thousands, if not millions, of people across the upper Midwest when we have these dark, cold days. And so to be able to have a week where, at a time when we shouldn't have, it's almost life-giving, you know, sunshine and warmth that people can kind of get through that winter season. So to your point, where it depends on where you're at, weather hits everybody differently, and it's hard to tell that story completely, especially in 45 seconds. But it is good to be curious about it, and then maybe just dig underneath a little bit more and be willing to ask the question why. I think that's when we start getting into some good conversations.
Well, and the ability to hold both of those emotions in your head at the same time, on the one hand, knowing that something is wrong here, and on the other hand, being able to enjoy a 70-degree sunny day for what it is.
Yeah, you know, we were talking off air. I was wondering maybe you could tell that story about some of the advice that you were given in your NPR days. I thought that was very fitting. So for everybody who's listening to this program, to understand the dilemma that we have as broadcasters, trying to tell a story that's going to reach or draw in the majority of our audience, some of the tension that you talked about is one of the things we have to carry. Do you mind sharing
that?
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. And that was back in my first public radio job in southern Minnesota. And we had a manager whose biggest pet peeve during weather forecasts involved the person giving the weather forecast describing the day as gloomy. And his I think, fairly well thought out line of thinking was, you know, gloomy is a mindset. It's not a weather condition. And I think his point was, you know, fog and drizzle might be terribly depressing to some people, but it might be refreshing to others. And, you know, and I think it gets at that issue of the weather doesn't happen independently of how we take it.
Right. Yeah. Wholeheartedly agree. And it becomes like I said, it becomes a challenge because some people are going to respond to that, that gloomy and that dark, and want to draw the shades and not look outside the window. For other people, you know, I'm thinking like a writer, you know, who's that writer block for everybody and is looking for the right environment to set the tension in the book. You look outside and it's foggy and hey, there it is. Yeah, some people will take it all different ways. And so for us, we try to draw the line between or maybe not draw the line, but walk the fine line of we're all fans of the weather, but try to allow that not everybody's going to be as excited about that 70-degree day in February or the whatever this winds up being, 18 inches of lake effect snow in March.
Well, Mike Westendorf, we're going to talk to you on a more regular basis, but I think it is appropriate that we got our regular conversation started with a conversation about the lake effect.
I think that is so apropos. It's perfect for it. It's a great way to start this relationship.
Mike Westendorf, thanks, and I'm going to go back to shoveling.
Me too.
Meteorologist Mike Westendorf is the director of operations at UW-Milwaukee's Innovative Weather. You can find the latest weather forecast for the Milwaukee area from Innovative Weather. It's right at WUWM.com.
And coming up after just one more break, we take a tour with artist Jeffrey Gibson and talk about his current show on view at the Hagerty Museum of Art. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
About the weather.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The exhibition space at the Hagerty Museum of Art is not large, but as you walk down the stairs into the first gallery space, you realize just how much can fit into the space without it feeling cramped. Native American artist Jeffrey Gibson works in a number of different media, from oil paint to assemblage and photography.
And a representation of all of it is part of the exhibition Look How Far We've Come, which is now on view at the Hagerty. Gibson is himself a representative of various groups that are often out of the mainstream. He comes from both Choctaw and Cherokee roots. He's gay, and he grew up both inside and outside of the United States. And that diverse background shows up in his work, including the piece on display he most wanted to talk about.
The work in the show covers about 2013 to some recent pieces that were completed in 2017. And I'm going to start with this piece right in front of us here, which is titled In Numbers Too Big to Ignore. In a lot of my work, I do reference lyrics of sometimes pop songs, disco songs, techno songs. And this one, of course, references Helen Reddy's
Anthem, even.
Anthem, exactly. And this piece was made in 2015. And this piece, really at the time, was in response to Black Lives Matter, after I had returned from some trips to Canada, mainly to Winnipeg, and met a number of families who had lost female Indigenous women to the growing number of nameless and undocumented murders and missing Indigenous women. So it wasn't so much counter to Black Lives Matter, but wanting to kind of diversify the lives of people of color who were being undocumented. And when you speak to many of the families who I spoke to, felt that the police were responsible and were also, I suppose, not, they were aiding the fact that these cases would not be investigated. And it was also after working in beadwork, paint, abstraction, trying to find ways that color would inherently mean something. So in this case, it's of course very red. And then there's this kind of gradation of color as we go into the center. There is a center. And it's been interesting with this exhibition, when we chose the title, Look How Far We've Come, that was in the summer of 2016. There's always been some social and political implications in the work and in the text that I choose, but really on a personal level. So with the current administration and everything going on in the country and the world, I feel as though now these words and numbers too big to ignore, in my mind, also relate to the number of people protesting for change, and also the power of numbers and collectivity and voice and speaking.
Were you prepared for your work to become, moving from the personal, the political as personal, to the political as cultural?
Right.
Were you ready for that? Was it something that you always thought your work might be able to articulate?
Yes. And in fact, I'm a strong believer that, you know, when we're in moments of distress, like many of the communities that I'm engaged in feel very much distress right now, instability, fear, panic, you're not making the best decisions. There's a huge amount of distraction. So I'm really very much a fan of trying to live ethically, compassionately, leading towards the maintenance of political civility before we're in an event like we are right now. So for me, the works have always been political, and oftentimes referring to past events, past cultural and political social movements, that there are still many questions surrounding how those things have unfolded, but there has been some level of resolve that I feel we can say is an achievement. But it is interesting, and I welcome the fact that people are able to see contemporary politics, because, you know, we live in a culture and society where there is a little bit of amnesia of what happened 20, 30 years ago. It seems as though it will never happen again. And in fact, I think as I've gotten older, you know, we really are cyclical, and that those cycles take a tremendous amount of energy to maintain that we don't go backwards. You know, so this idea of comfort, and I do teach, so the idea of comfort may be found in liberal circles is something that I've always been a bit distrustful of, because I'm like, don't get too comfortable, because it's the minute when you're too comfortable that suddenly things start fraying at the edges, you know?
Do you feel any responsibility for reaching the non-liberal audience? Is that something that you've ever try to do, or is it so important that the communities that you're working with and representing, that they just haven't had a voice for so long, that that's where your energy is?
That's a really complex question, because I am interested in talking to conservative people. I think that in my what I do as an artist and educator, I meet plenty of conservative people who we do not share political views, but I am able to see and acknowledge that they are really smart. They have a huge amount to contribute. And so I never want to shut that conversation off, because there's a level of conversation where we're able to meet maybe about a common issue, and we have different perspectives on what resolve means. But that conversation is fruitful. On the other hand, I think there's a vulnerability in the work on a personal level, about race, about sexual choices, freedoms, rights, that really comes from a very individual and personal place. That my hopes is that in sharing it, because I know I appear very much as a functional person in the world, but just to let people know that, you know, function is oftentimes an overcompensation for something much more vulnerable underneath. So as an artist, I have the opportunity to kind of layer those things.
Well, and it's so perfect in that you straddle so many different worlds, you know, in your art and in your personal experience of the world, that I would be surprised if this ability to layer wasn't there too.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, and I also think, the layering is... You're always opening up to engage with the complexities of your life, as opposed to repression or as opposed to performance. And once you open up to the complexities, I actually think that's probably where we find more similarities between, you know, our views on just life. You know, your relationships to your loved ones, your children, your parents, your ancestors. I think that those things lie underneath the performances and the repressions and really do bring us together much more than separate us.
It's where the juicy stuff is, too.
It is. It is. It's where the answers lie, that when you dig up some juicy bit and you're like, oh, that's why it all makes sense. You know, that's why they never spoke.
I get it.
We certainly have those.
We all do.
Yeah.
And I am looking around the corner here, seeing some. I want you to take me to and talk about it's more beadwork, and then we'll get to that wonderful figure in the middle. Mm-hmm. But tell me a little bit about this piece.
So this is actually the piece that I knew I was already going to make before I met Amelia Layden, who's the assistant curator here at the Haggerty, but really the one who I worked with the most. And I knew I was going to make this piece with the words, "Look how far we've come." And I remember feeling at the time that those words almost seemed kind of corny. You know, it was like, what are you really saying? Look how far we've come. I don't generally choose things that have any sense of irony to them. A lot of the formats that I choose, especially because I do, it's interesting that I started getting invited by textile departments of schools and universities, and I thought, I'm not a textile artist. And then I realized, oh, no.
You kind of are.
I kind of am. But was the idea of the difference between, let's say, a cultural garment versus fashion. So within the Native American context of powwow, there's a difference between the outfit versus the costume. Right. And so, and it's always an outfit. You know, this is what you wear when you dance. So historically, whether it's like a Chilkat robe or it's a chief's robe, this is not something that just anyone can put on. This is something made specifically for this role. And when you put it on, you assume an extraordinary position within the context of, let's say, in this case, ceremony. So those are my influences and references. I wanted to make cloaks, I refer to this as a cloak, that are so impractical that they actually change the way you move. These are so heavy that they literally, some people I think could not hold them up. It's difficult for me to hold up. I've put this on before and it probably weighs about, my guess would be 100 to 120 pounds. So to have that on your shoulders with all of this metal that makes sound when you move, there's no way you can function as you do in your normal life with this on. And it's displayed very much the way that you would see a historical object shown in terms of trying to, put it on the wall in a 2D rather than in movement or on a body. So this piece, Look How Far We've Come, the words are definitely there to acknowledge. I do think there's been a huge amount of achievement socially, politically, within the realm of social justice, certainly since I was born, 1972. And definitely there's a huge amount to go, but at least we're dealing with a public who knows that a woman's right to her body is her right. You know, we have the pop cultural notion of that. We know that lynching is wrong. These things might seem so obvious, but it's an achievement that it seems obvious to think that there was a time when those things seemed absurd.
Not that long ago.
Not that long ago.
Yeah.
I always try to choose words that are not didactic. They're not necessarily accusatory, but they're open-ended enough that the viewer is left to really consider how those words sit. And previously, I've been referencing previous social protest movements, counterculture movements, and here we are in another one where young people who I've spoken to a lot of classes here from MIAD and from Marquette are feeling very much the irony of this statement and questioning, you know, how does the celebration of what we've achieved, what does that mean in the face of a bullyish president who refuses to acknowledge a lot of things and literally has wiped those histories off of our national, you know, image in certain ways. So I hope that the work will continue to, the words in particular, you know, and a lot of the words, look how far we've come, is something which I don't exactly know the originating point. I think it's something that I have always related to different social movements. But yeah, that's how I choose the words.
It's interesting that the words are so important for mm-hmm. a visual artist. Mm-hmm. I find that layering in your work so interesting, that the words are there for a very specific reason, even if you're not exactly sure what
right.
that is.
Right.
You look at this, if you looked at this piece and you took those words out,
right.
it would be very, very different.
Very different.
And mean something very different,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting working with abstraction. And if I took the words out, we're really looking at abstraction. Abstraction of materials, collage of materials. But what the words do is they name my subjectivity. You know, so I'm telling you, look how far we've come. If it's a garment that you're going to wear, this is what it looks like in Jeffrey Gibson's world. And part of that is probably having grown up and being so engrossed by the biographies of artists and creative people and leaders who, you know, we might know an achievement of theirs, but only when you see the whole or you understand the narrative of their life that maybe there's something really personal in there that really is why this was so important to them. So I think, and before the text was on the actual art objects, the text was always in the title. And that has always been there since I started making artwork. But what happened was I was garnering an audience that loved the formal qualities, the color, the shape of what I was making, but I wasn't able to get the personal narrative and importance across. And that has always really been the point of why it's important for me to make. And so I remember it was just a day of thinking, well, what's the most direct way I can do this? And it was putting the words directly onto the piece. And I think it is, it's encouraged me to think about words differently. It's encouraged me to write and to think about the difficulty of forming a voice, to author your own voice.
Tell your own story.
Yeah. And it's also become increasingly important for me to see them as homages to people who have articulated maybe my emotions for me before I knew how to do it. And maybe that's what a really great pop song that you can't stop listening to is doing. You know, it's articulating your heartbreak. It's articulating your love. It's articulating your loss and your mourning or your celebration. A lot of the original song lyrics that I was working from were from gay club anthems of the 80s and 90s. And I thought, you know, why were those songs so important to me? And it was always because I was in the process of coming out, and I was never sure if these artists who I wanted to think were gay or lesbian were singing about a same-sex partner they were longing for. But their decision to leave the pronouns in some level of ambiguity made space for me to interject myself with the pronoun that I was interested in. So there's that openness that I think, and of course within the decorative arts, there have always been people who have found ways to tell stories and leave clues and love notes to people because they couldn't be revealed publicly. So it's not so much that I'm interested in revealing that, because I think many people already understand that. But I do think that it's a very powerful place to work on a social and political level, to, you know, put things, inject things in the places where people don't expect to find them, you know.
Yeah. And something you said just a minute ago, leave room for people to insert themselves into that space that they find.
Right. And so, and to go back to what you were saying before, like, do I want to talk to liberals or, you know, right wing or whoever? I think sometimes, I'm sure there are people who on the surface are performing somebody who I would not share their politics with, who might outrightly say that my lifestyle is wrong. But maybe underneath all of that performance, maybe they're feeling the same way. And we all know that wouldn't be unheard of, you know? And so I think that the work is also for them. It is also for the people who, for whatever reason, feel that they, you know, it provides a little bit of an outlet for them to say that, you know, they understand what they're looking at.
Right. I was going to say it allows them to have their own narrative in a way that's safe.
Yeah. And the empowering part of that for me is I don't need their approval to make a successful artwork. And that was such a great thing to realize. You know, there's plenty of an audience for me to speak to. There's plenty of growth for me as an individual person in making these things. It's not that I approve of their dislike, hate, whatever, but it's nice to know that I'm not dependent on their approval.
Jeffrey Gibson's exhibit, Look How Far We've Come, is on display at the Hagerty Museum of Art on the Marquette University campus through May 21st. You can hear an extended version of this interview at WUWM.com. And that's all for the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. We are just about an hour away from all the latest news from around the country and the world on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now, it's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.